Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Haldit. Coming up in a few minutes, Kentucky Public Radio's Ron Smith takes a look at two people from opposite ends of the political spectrum who are working together to create change at the Bluegrass Army Depot. First, in the new film, Awake, the lead character finds himself awake and aware but paralyzed during open heart surgery. That frightening occurrence is called anesthesia awareness. To find out more about it, I spoke with Dr. Laura Clark, professor of anesthesiology and perioperative medicine at the University of Louisville. At the time of our conversation, she had not yet seen the film. I began by asking Dr. Clark just how often anesthesia awareness occurs.
Well, it's a relatively rare occurrence. The incidence has been fairly consistent at about 0.1 to 0.2%. There was like three studies done, one in Australia, one in the United States, and one in Sweden. And when they looked at different cohorts of people, they really found this consistency of the 0.1 to 0.2%.
For lack of a better term, when these people wake up, is it a brief thing, or does it go on for a period of time?
Well, it actually runs a whole spectrum. It's usually a brief occurrence that, you know, they call it explicit memory. In other words, they will remember some aspect. This does not count the part where you are waking up from anesthesia, where somebody might say, well, I remember the endotracheal tube in my throat.
Right.
It ranges, you know, the movie sensationalizes the absolute worst case scenario, and that is that someone is under surgery, being operated on, and they're paralyzed. In other words, they have been given muscle relaxants so they can't move, but they're not asleep, so they can't respond. That is like the epitome of the worst case scenario. Some cases can just be minor, that I remembered hearing voices in the OR, or it could just be something like a lot of people don't even realize what that is, that they've had some kind of dream. It's not dreaming under anesthesia, but they might think of it as a dream. So that's two different entities there. But it runs the whole gamut. I actually, when I was looking at this and talking about this several years ago, I found out my aunt had awareness under anesthesia. And she said it happened to her both times. She had surgery. And I said, well, what happened to you? And she said, well, I could hear them talking. I didn't feel pain. You don't always feel pain. But she was one of those cases where she was paralyzed and asleep and remembered. And I said, well, does that bother you? And she said, no, I understood, and that was fine. But they found that it's not something that you catch oftentimes right away. People need to be interviewed anywhere from 1 to 2 days or even a week afterwards. And a lot of them don't even realize this because it can be manifested almost like a post-traumatic stress disorder in some cases. Some people need counseling afterward for it, and other people say, no, I'm fine. I don't really need anything. We encourage people that if they have cases of awareness to receive counseling just to make sure that they can understand that this is something that can be dealt with.
Is this generally the result, doctor, of not enough anesthesia being administered?
Well, it's a result of for some reason, not enough anesthesia is administered. You know, in some cases, there are, quote, high-risk patients. And usually high-risk means that for some reason they can't tolerate the normal amount of anesthesia. Oftentimes a trauma patient or a heart patient, meaning their blood pressure, the anesthesia needs to be turned down for safety for them, for safety reasons. Another one is C-section patients that have to have general, which is a rare subset, but they try to minimize the amount of anesthesia so that the anesthesia doesn't affect the baby and make the baby sleepy. So those are kind of three high-risk patients, and that's one of the trials that they did in Australia was targeting this high-risk patient. But it can also be from an adequate delivery. Perhaps the IV was kinked, or perhaps the vaporizer ran out, or it could just be a person's own inherent variability You know, everybody is kind of on this bell-shaped curve. Some people might require more anesthesia than others. Some people might require less, and that's, you know, a whole different issue kind of thing. But it can be not only for not enough anesthesia, but not enough anesthesia for that particular person.
I see. Now, have you had people since this film has come out come to you and say, I'm really worried about this happening to me?
Well, I have that not only because of this movie, but there will be people that ask about it. And, you know, the most common thing is for people to say, I don't want to know anything. And, you know, if anything, this movie is doing something, you know, to something good, and that's allowing us to teach people about anesthesia. You know, anesthesia has really become quite safe. And there was a recent article in the Wall Street Journal, I believe, it was in June of 2005, talking about how anesthesia has made a patient safety foundation and one of the first specialties to do that. And instead by looking at issues that they can do to increase safety, anesthesia death now has really improved to less than one death per 200 to 300,000 cases.
I see. You say you're going to go see the movie soon?
Yeah, I'm going to go see it. I've got to go see what happens. I know they've sensationalized it, and I know they are, you know, it's Hollywood, and I know the producer has said that they wanted, that this would do to anesthesia what Jaws did to swimming in the ocean.
Oh,
and that's a quote that the producer did, but I've really heard that the movie's kind of bombing, just on its whole storyline.
Yeah.
But if anything, you know, I take it I like to educate about people about anesthesia, and they need to know more about it. Lots of times it's kind of this forgotten issue. You know, if we do a great job, you don't remember what we do, and that's good.
That's right. That's what you want. Well, Dr. Clark, thanks for your time this morning. I appreciate it.
Sure. Glad to do it.
That's Dr. Laura Clark, professor of anesthesiology and perioperative medicine at the University of Louisville. More information about anesthesia awareness is available at our website, WFPL.org. Strange Bedfellows, The Odd Couple. Those are just two terms people have been using to describe the relationship between conservative U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky and social activist Craig Williams. Kentucky Public Radio's Ron Smith takes a look at their relationship and the politics involved.
I thought what the Army was proposing for this community was wrong. And I wasn't just going to sit there and say, okay, well, I guess if you say it's okay, it's okay. That's not what I didn't think that then. I don't think it now.
That's an example of Craig Williams' tenacity. As one colleague puts it, not letting go until the job is done. It's been nearly 20 years since Williams first challenged the Army's proposal to incinerate its aging chemical weapons stockpile. As head of the Chemical Weapons Working Group, he continues to argue for the safe disposal of the deadly munitions. It's serious stuff, to be sure, made to sound even more sobering by Williams' gruff, no-nonsense voice. The 60-year-old does have a lighter side, but even that never seems far away from contentious chemical weapons issues.
I offer you the following call to the funding derby, a $2 billion stakes race. The horses are being loaded into the chute. On the rail is the Pentagon, the favorite in this year's event. Next to them is Senator Mitch McConnell, representing the citizens of Kentucky. Not a long shot by any means. His experience, having run in so many derbies over the years, will serve him well. But it will still take a tremendous amount of focused effort for him to keep the pace. In the next five gates are other members of the Kentucky...
Williams' playful but pointed sense of humor was on display in May of 2005 at a working group appreciation luncheon for Senator Mitch McConnell. On the surface, McConnell and Williams appear to be political opposites. Nothing better illustrates their differences as their positions on the Iraq War.
In fact, when he visited Berea not too long ago, there were some protesters outside the luncheon that he was speaking at. And I joined those protesters in voicing my opinion about that, and then joined him at the luncheon shortly thereafter. And then immediately after that, I was back out on the street voicing my opposition to his position on the war. And we've both respected each other's differences in that regard.
And contrary to what some might believe, Williams says he and the senator are actually on the same page on other issues. For example, both oppose a constitutional prohibition on flag burning and agree on components of some education bills. But the issue on which Williams and McConnell are as close as blood brothers is their effort to rid central Kentucky of 523 tons of chemical weapons stored at the Lexington Bluegrass Army Depot near Richmond. McConnell, who's up for re-election in 2008, refers to Williams' contributions on the senator's campaign website.
For more than two decades, Craig Williams has been working to ensure that these chemical weapons are destroyed safely so that they can neither harm our neighbors nor fall into the hands of our enemies. His tireless dedication to this cause makes Craig a true Kentucky hero.
Williams says McConnell has not asked for his political endorsement and would not do so, but Williams has taped comments on the nerve gas issue, which are included on McConnell's re-election website.
The same year that the Army announced their intentions to incinerate these chemical weapons was the same year the senator was first elected to office. This was one of the first issues to greet him in Washington. And we've worked very closely with him ever since.
Their mutual admiration, even on weapons disposal, makes some people uncomfortable. Chemical Weapons Working Group Program Director Elizabeth Crow, who has worked with Williams for 15 years, says that's not the case with her or the group's other members.
Nobody has a problem at all with the relationship, and it's because the CWWG has always been very legislatively strategic. That is, we all, for everybody at all the chemical weapons sites, works really hard to try to keep their legislators informed and engaged in the issue and tries to get them, encourage them to take action to protect their communities.
Craig Williams says he hears criticism of his relationship with McConnell from those people on the political left all the time, while he says the senator gets heat from the conservative right. As Williams sees it, both men are just playing the cards they've been dealt.
He is our senator. He's the senior senator from Kentucky. He sits on the Defense Appropriations Committee, and he's the minority leader in the United States Senate. If you can find me someone else in Kentucky with those credentials, I'd be happy to work with them as well.
Far more important than making political points, says Williams, is completing the safe destruction of chemical munitions warehoused at the Bluegrass Depot and at other sites around the country. He won't say how he voted in past elections or how he'll vote in 2008, but Williams says Senator McConnell knows how he's voted, and it will remain their secret. Mitch McConnell and Craig Williams may well be an odd couple, but they may also be an example of how seemingly incompatible individuals can partner to address the nation's complex problems. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Ron Smith.
When we come back, Kristen Espelon brings us a report on a hydroelectric plant on the Kentucky River. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Haldet. Coming up a little later in the show, Nicole Irwin takes us inside the trucking industry. First, renewable energy isn't as affordable yet as fossil fuel energy, but the growing green power market could help offset the cost and encourage new green power development. That's what's happening for a small hydroelectric plant on the Kentucky River. WFPL's Kristen Espelon reports.
The first time water flowing over the Lock 7 Dam near Harrodsburg was spun into energy was 1927. Electricity flowed from this hydroelectric plant for the next 72 years until the generators fell into disrepair and its owners abandoned it around 1999. Enter David Brown Kinlock, president of Lock 7 Hydro Partners. Inside the plant's generator room, high above the churning water, he says the plant's owners had given up.
Actually, they wanted to tear it down, and we stepped in and bought it from them, and they're in the process of getting it completely running again and modernized.
Since then, he's restored two of the plant's three generators, which in 1927, he says, were top of the line. Today, these iron behemoths look like giant vintage spaceships, and Kinlock runs between them and the more modern 1980s control panel like a mad scientist. As he powers up the first unit, Kinlock explains what's happening far below us.
The water goes in and goes past a propeller, and the propeller turns and is hooked to a 40-foot long shaft. The shaft comes up and directly connects to the generator, and each of them are capable of putting out 680 kilowatts.
When the three generators are fully up and running, they'll produce enough electricity to power about 1,000 homes. That energy zips across the river and enters the grid at Salt River Electric and just becomes part of the general pool of electricity available. That means you can't buy this power directly, but you can buy a block of green energy from LG&E or KU for $5 a month. It's part of a young but growing industry called green energy marketing. Three utilities market green power in Kentucky, but this is the first time a utility is marketing hydropower as part of their green energy program. And there are firms that specialize in helping utilities market green energy. LG&E and KU signed on with one of them called 3Degrees. It buys and sells renewable energy credits. 3Degrees spokesman Gabe Petlin.
It's a way to verify that 1 megawatt hour of renewable energy has been generated and then delivered to the grid. And each time a megawatt hour of clean renewable energy is delivered to the grid, there's one less megawatt hour of polluting power needed.
3Degrees has agreed to buy one certificate from the Lock 7 station for every megawatt hour of energy it produces. That's revenue David Brown Kinlock can use to keep repairing the aging plant. 3Degrees will then sell these certificates to LG&E and KU. The idea is both to offset the effects of polluting energy as well as to finance a renewable energy project. But the utilities have to convince customers to sign up for the program. Petlin says that's where his firm fits in.
One of the biggest unknowns for a utility in this is how much demand is there. So how do they know how many certificates they should buy? So we guarantee to them to deliver certificates at a fixed price, no matter what their demand is.
And then Petlin says they go shopping for those certificates on behalf of the utility. Lock 7's hydroelectric project fit the bill. That's in part because it's local, but also because it's been certified by the Low Impact Hydro Institute. Up on the plant's roof, Kinlock says he believes there's never been a better time for hydroelectric power. He says it used to be difficult even to get utilities or developers to talk to him, but attitudes have changed.
We've been doing this for about 20 years, and it's just in the last few years that things have turned around with concerns about the environment, that it's really been to the point where it looks like we can make a go of it.
To do that, Kinlock will need to sell as many certificates as possible and hope utility customers sign up for the program. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
Funding for Kentucky's colleges and universities will be among the issues at the forefront of the next General Assembly in Frankfort. The Kentucky Chamber of Commerce is urging lawmakers to follow up on recommendations made in a new report it commissioned assessing Kentucky's higher education system. The report was unveiled this month and passed along to education leaders, lawmakers, and Governor Steve Beshear. I spoke with Kentucky Chamber of Commerce President David Akison about the report and what happens now. Well, let me ask you first of all about a little background about the report. What prompted the study?
Well, 2007 is the 10th anniversary of the big reforms of higher education that took place in 1997. That's when higher education among our colleges and universities, public colleges and universities, was restructured in Kentucky. And they set some goals for the year 2020. In other words, in 1997, they said by 2020, we want to be at the national average in terms of per capita income here in Kentucky. And to do that, we're going to have to produce more of our population with bachelor's degrees. So this is a 10th anniversary review that the business community decided to take on to see how we're doing and where we're falling short.
Well, what did they find progress we've made in the last decade?
Well, there are certainly some encouraging signals. Enrollments are up at the universities. Their graduation rates, in other words, the number of their students that are actually getting a bachelor's degree or an associate degree, are up fairly significantly, and in some cases dramatically. The community college system has been a success in terms of, you might recall that 10 years ago they were separate from our vocational schools. They were combined in 97, and making that adjustment and was a difficult period for them, but they've come out of that very well with strong enrollment. So there are some encouraging signals. The bottom line of the report is that we're going to have to pick up the pace, though, if we plan to make our goal by the year 2020. A key task now will be to determine how much progress can we make in the 2008 legislative session. The report calls for a revitalization of the Council on Post-Secondary Education. That's the group that's the coordinating body, or meant to be the coordinating body among the universities, so that when the legislature's in session, you don't have each of the colleges and universities doing whatever they're politically strong enough to do in the legislature, but instead they're working as a unit. So we can advance Kentucky's higher education, the funding, et cetera, that we can advance that for the benefit of the state as opposed to individual institutions.
Now, as we speak, you unveiled this report a couple of days ago. How has it been received?
Very positively. I'm sure there will be some concerns in certain quarters. It wouldn't be much of a report probably if it didn't stir some concerns. But I think generally it calls for all of us to pull together to reestablish some of the intended discipline of the 1997 reforms. It certainly does not throw out the 97 reforms. It underscores them and says, yes, let's keep our shoulder to the wheel, but we've got to pick up the pace if we're going to make our goals. One of the boldest recommendations has to do with how students afford to go to college. We went around the state and held town meetings, listening to people and their concerns about higher education and their regional economies, job production, and all of that. And probably the biggest concern that's on the minds of a lot of students and parents is the affordability or lack of affordability of college. And while our universities are roughly in line with comparable universities, still there's a perception out there and to some extent a reality that folks see major financial barriers. That's especially true among adult students wanting to come back to college or university. So in this report is recommended a very bold, they call it an affordability model. In other words, after you determine how much it costs for a university to keep its doors open and to serve a certain number of students, then you can determine how much is an affordable level of tuition and fees that student should pay. And this proposal calls for the state to make a pledge that while college won't be free, it will be affordable, and the state will assure the dollars to close any gap that exists between what a student can pay and what that college has to have to keep its doors open.
That was Kentucky Chamber of Commerce President David Akison. A copy of the higher education report he discussed is available from the chamber. Pick up any newspaper today and peek into the Help Wanted section, and you'll find many of the ads read, Drivers Wanted. Kentucky Public Radio's Nicole Irwin explains the evolution of the trucking industry since deregulation in the early 1980s.
If every tractor trailer in, I'm just going to say the United States, if they would park their trucks for 3 days, the United States would come to a halt, because 90% of everything that you use, somewhere, somehow, a tractor trailer bring it.
Thomas DeGree is a professional in the trucking industry and has transported goods for more than 34 years. Historically, the trucking industry has been a bellwether for the nation's economic health. Executive Vice President of Pascal Trucklines in Murray, Tom Stevens, says the industry is typically the first to go into a recession and the first to leave.
We've been in this, nobody wants to use the word recession, for probably better than a year and a half now. And it's because our freight has diminished. And we had excess capacity. Excess capacity means there's more trucks than the amount of freight.
Stephen says the excess capacity is largely due to Katrina, which required several individuals to purchase trucks and trailers to make short runs of food, water, and other supplies.
Unfortunately, you know, it's sad to say that here we are worrying about another catastrophe. There wasn't one in 06, and there hasn't been one in 07. So we have all these excess trucks and not enough freight moving. And the housing industry is a perfect example.
The turnover rate in the trucking industry is approximately 128% and growing. Stevens attributes the high rate to not only the economy, but the hardships the road can bring, being away from home, family, and long hours of isolation.
Product doesn't move just 8 to 5, and so they're paid by the mile. If the miles aren't there to haul the freight, the guy's going to say, well, Pascal doesn't have the miles, I'm going to go to Heartland. Then he goes to Heartland, finds the same thing. He says, well, then their Knight must have it. And they just keep turning, and they keep turning with among us carriers. And we have guys come back and say, you know, I thought the grass was greener on the other side. It really isn't. They're having the same problems as you are.
Computer broadcast technician Alvy Grant drove a truck for 22 years and logged in close to 2 million miles on the road. He worked for 6 different companies and was an owner-operator for 3 years. Grant says he got out of trucking because he became disillusioned with the industry. It no longer paid what he felt he was worth.
The trucking industry is more or less hard scrabble as far as I'm concerned. In the late 60s, early 70s, I was making $35,000 to $40,000. Today, a lot of the truck drivers are still only making that $35,000 to $40,000, and the cost of living has increased dramatically since that time.
The 60s and 70s were very different than today. Tom Stevens credits the growth of the industry to deregulation.
In 1980, I think Jimmy Carter and Alfred Kahn got together and said, we've deregulated the banking industry, we ought to deregulate the trucking industry. And when they did that, anyone could go and get a truck and trailer and put any rate they wanted on it. It was a major, major impact for trucking as we knew it in the regulated environment.
Deregulation allowed independent carriers or non-union companies to generate competitive rates. These competitive rates prompted new demands for more drivers and newer equipment. The increased cost associated with these new demands were funded by what would have normally been drivers' pay. Program director and CDL trainer at West Kentucky Technical College, Gary Girton, says satisfied carriers and truckers are rare these days.
You'll never find a perfect trucking company. You know, companies are, you know, a bad thing is you got some companies when freight gets slow. You might be in Colorado and you may have to sit 2 or 3 days. Well, if they're sitting, they're not making money. That makes them mad.
Trucking isn't the only method for transport, remember. And Tom Stevens says there is really only one competitor in hauling freight, and that's the railroad.
You're going to have your airlines moving the overnight stuff, 53,000 pounds or 40,000 pounds, but it becomes cost prohibitive for them. But the rails can take 60 or 80,000 pounds on a rail car and be able to move it. But a railroad has specific spots it can go to. Once it gets there, how is it going to move? It's got to move by truck.
Approximately 300,000 trucks move product daily. Stephen says he hopes to see the economy take an uptick, which he doesn't predict will happen to the middle of next year.
Truck drivers risk a lot to be on the road, often missing birthdays, graduations, games, and even funerals. For more on why these diesel cowboys risk losing these precious moments to ride the road, again, here's Nicole Irwin.
It takes a special kind of person to drive a truck. Whether that drive is innate or nurtured, one thing is for sure. The trucking life is a part of them. Truck driver wife Holly Thompson Bray says it's in the blood.
It's one of those obsessions, and they have to be on the move, and they have to go, and they have to do what they do. You know, if you ever start trucking, you're probably a trucker for life.
Bob, a trucker who wishes to remain anonymous, has been driving for 23 years. He says he knew his calling before the eighth grade.
I had a good friend with me. He would be my trailer. I would be the truck, and I would go through the halls, go from one class to another, changing gears, act like I was driving a big truck. And then when I get in the classroom, I'm backing up, he's unhooking, and I'll get back to my desk and let the air brakes off. But I knew at an early age what I wanted to do, and I pursued that dream.
Bob is the only truck driver in his family.
Typically, most truck drivers enter the industry after their father or grandfather.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of scary things on the road.
Billy Ray O'Kelly is a truck driver from Royston, Georgia. His father and his uncles on both sides of the family were truck drivers, and his mother worked at a truck stop. He says he knows the life of a trucker is hard, and a person best fit for the job is someone that has no one.
You got a family. The loneliest person in the world is a truck driver's wife.
Holly Bray rode in the truck with her husband for 3 years. In that time, she saw 48 states, three provinces of Canada, and Mexico. Shortly after her time on the road, she bore a child, had to stay home, and things changed.
It takes a special person to be able to cope with all of the things that happen. When the water heater goes out, when you get a leak in the ceiling, you have nobody there to turn to.
A special report featured in Consumer Health Interactive says trucker marriages far exceed the nation's divorce rate. Truckers in the industry guess that 75% or more marriages fail. Holly Bray says a lot of the problems are psychological.
Right before he would get ready to go, he would get mad or cause confusion, cause an argument. And we figured out that it was subconsciously he thought that if he got out there and something happened to him, if he left and I was mad at him, that I wouldn't feel so bad.
Beyond the stresses of worrying where your spouse is, truckers have a multitude of other things to be concerned with, like pulling an 80,000-pound rig. Trucker Thomas DeGree has been on the road more than 34 years. He says a lot of problems stem from disrespect from the four-wheelers, which is slang for the smaller vehicles on the road.
They literally dislike truck drivers. It's not a point of a truck driver wants to dominate the road or try to dominate the highway. It's the point of he has a job to do. Why would you come off the off-ramp and you see a truck trailer coming? He can't get over. He's running top speed. Why would you pull out in front of him and slow down?
Other accidents are blamed on the inexperienced truck drivers, those who have been on the road less than 3 years. Most companies require their truckers to attend a trucking school, which consists of 3 weeks of training, 40 hours in the classroom, and 120 hours on the road. Program coordinator and senior instructor for CDL training at West Kentucky Community and Technical College, Gary Gerton, says tuition is around $3,400 for his students, most of which have never set foot in a truck.
Other drivers will say I'm crazy because I do this. They learn how to turn, learn how to work in traffic. I take them through the constructions, country roads, four lanes, but they start from nothing, and we end up taking them to the state trooper barracks during their last week here, and they actually do their tests with them.
Every job has its ups and downs. With trucking, you're either running full throttle or sitting for days waiting on a load. Trucker Billy Ray O'Kelly says you have to think long and hard before becoming a trucker, but if you do, there are gorgeous things that lie ahead.
When I'm in my truck, I'm by myself, I shut off my CV, and I'm on that long stretch on that desert, just hearing the motor hum, watching that sun start dropping, then your skies turn real pretty, and you see them cactuses on the side of the road. They begin to take shape, look like people in the middle of the night, you know, real beautiful.
For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Nicole Irwin.
He's bound and down, loaded up and trucking. Are we gonna do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm eastbound, just watch old Bandit run. Keep your foot hard on the pedal, some devil mind them brakes. Let it all hang out, cause we got a run to make. The boys are thirsty in Atlanta, and there's beer in Texarkana. And we'll bring it back no matter what it takes. Eastbound and down, loaded up and trucking. Are we gonna do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm eastbound, just watch old Bandit run.
When we come back, Robin Fisher talks with Dr. Giovanni Fava about well-being therapy. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldon. We've all been down in the dumps at times. For some, the holidays are the final straw that leads to depression. But what if it's more than just an occasional blip on your personal radar? Millions of people worldwide suffer from chronic depression, and it's a challenge for both the doctors and the patients to find a solution. Dr. Giovanni Fava from the University of Bologna has developed a therapy method he hopes will help. WFPL's Robin Fisher spoke with Dr. Fava about well-being therapy.
I want to start sort of at the beginning, and I want you to define well-being for us, because it's so much more than just being happy.
Right. Happiness doesn't mean much. I mean, a lot of people may say they are happy, and this does not have a particular meaning. There was a survey in American jails a few years ago, and one of the questions were, are you happy? And most of the inmates reply, yes. So I doubt that American jails are as comfortable as American hotels. So this really means that happiness is a state of mind which cannot be so easily captured, and which has great variability among people. So we are talking about psychological well-being, which is actually your attitude to life.
Oh, so so happiness could, maybe it's a component of well-being.
Happiness is a consequence of your attitude to life. I mean, we are talking about something which is, say, it's consists of various elements. For instance, your sense of autonomy, of environmental mastery. Your sense of personal growth, the fact that you're growing, you keep on growing even though you're no longer a child, your interpersonal relationships with other people, and all these elements which have been outlined by an American psychologist, Carol Reif, who works at the University of Wisconsin, are very important in determining our state of mind.
Well, I find it interesting that someone would study well-being. It almost seems like one of those things that once someone started to study it, everyone thought, why didn't we look at this before? And I wonder, how did you come to that area?
Well, yeah, it was a sort of coincidence, because I've been working in the depression field for many, many years, and always dealing with sadness, depression, mental pain. And I was looking for strategies which may increase the likelihood of getting better and staying better even though without drugs. And at an international conference about 10 years ago, there was a talk by Carol Reif, and she started her talk saying, well, I've devoted all my life to studying psychological well-being. And at that moment, I thought, I've devoted all my professional life to studying depression and sadness, so it's time for a change. and I became interested in this possibility of increasing psychological well-being. And the idea behind it was that by doing this, your likelihood to have a relapse and depression may decrease.
I have read that the well-being therapy is works well with people with affective disorders. And I wondered if you could tell our listeners what those are, or just give them an idea.
Well, you see, in my opinion, most of the news on depression today is very depressing. In other words, there is a lot of emphasis on drug treatment, the fact that there are drugs which are effective against depression, and that you have to take these drugs for long periods of time. There is a lot of emphasis on new drugs, and each time patients, relatives, caregivers think, oh, now there will be a wonder drug which will sweep depression away, and particularly its most important aspect, the fact that depression tends to recur. But then all these expectations do not pass the test of time, and people discover that there are no wonder drugs, and that depression tends to be chronic. So we develop at the University of Bologna, where I work in Italy, a new strategy which has the aim of increasing psychological well-being in patients who have been treated for depression. And by doing this, these patients have been shown to be less likely to recur. In other words, if you are able to protect yourself, to increase your psychological well-being by changing your lifestyle, by acting on certain attitudes, you are less likely to recur.
Now, how does the well-being therapy work? Do I come into your office, I'm depressed, and you say, we're going to try this? Or do you say, you look good, buck up?
No. We should actually differentiate well-being therapy from some sort of naive endorsement of be happy, right. Don't worry, try to get the best out of everything. If a patient comes to my office and is depressed, the first thing, and as a major depression, the first thing that I do is to prescribe some antidepressant drugs. However, antidepressant drugs are good for curing the acute episode of depression. But they do not actually prevent relapse. They simply delay recurrence if you keep on taking the drugs. So you need something else, and you need a form of psychotherapy which is, in a way, self-therapy, guided by someone who's trying to make you emphasize the good parts of your personality and attitudes. It's pretty much similar to other strategies that are subsumed under the rubric of cognitive behavioral therapy. But it's basically a self-therapy.
I have read that it works particularly well with children and adolescents.
Right. We have some preliminary results, and of course they need to be replicated. But what was astonishing is that if you go, these studies were done in Italy, if you go into a classroom in Italy, and we're talking about 12-year-old kids, you're just astonished about the amount of anxiety, fears, problems, distress you encounter. And what we did was a sort of control study. Some classes had 2-hour meetings which were based on the concept of well-being therapy. And children were taught to talk about positive feelings, also among each other, or changing some attitudes, whereas other classes had simple meetings for discussing emotions or other feelings. And what was amazing is the fact that 4 2-hour sessions were able to make significant changes in the psychological well-being of these children. And even more, we went to see how these children were 1 year later. And the improvement had continued. Whereas in the class where we didn't do this well-being therapy, any improvement had vanished. This means that you can do a lot for improving psychological well-being in childhood, at school, in classes. And by doing this, maybe you are preventing more serious problems at some later point in time.
Do you think that this is something that eventually can be incorporated into, not necessarily the curriculum, but sort of the day-to-day work done with children at schools? I mean, it seems that this has potential for reshaping a school day.
Right. I think it does. I think that too many times students do not really receive any teachings about some values. For instance, Italian students now take a lot of pride in what they wear, what type of life they can do, what type of vacation, what type of bike they have, but very little on other things such as the value of friendship, interpersonal relationships, of learning something, and on self-acceptance, some good and bad parts of yourself. If these values are really incorporated in teaching, they may counteract the very detrimental effects that TV has on these children.
How can you take what you're learning from the children and translate that into treating adults?
Well, it's of course it's a quite different field because in adults, even though it may be conceivable that in certain settings such as at work or in hospitals or other centers, you may actually do some well-being therapy. In adults, the emphasis is on preventing relapse, increasing your level of recovery. There are a lot of patients who actually, because of psychiatric treatment, get better, but do not feel well. This means that whenever treatment and proper treatment and very adequate treatment is provided, it may be successful in decreasing certain symptoms, but not in yielding a full recovery. It's like very often my patients ask me, for instance, when they are in the midst of a depressive episode, will I go back to the way I was? And my answer is always, I really hope not. This will be a disaster. You should improve on what you were. So there is this idea that life is a continuous growth. Of course, this is not something which I devise or develop. It comes from ancient Latin and Greek philosophy, and particularly Seneca. The fact that that you can learn things in life, reflecting and trying to improve yourself, as Leonardo da Vinci wrote when he was 70. I'm still learning.
Dr. Fava, thank you for your time today.
You're welcome.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with Dr. Giovanni Fava about depression treatment and well-being therapy. Dr. Fava was in Louisville for the launch of the U of L Depression Center and the related conference. More information is available at our website, WFPL.org. More information about today's show is available online at WFPL.org. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.